Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins, the weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
Well, today we're joined by Devin O'Day. He's the Chief Development Officer for First Responder Wellness in Newport Beach, and we're excited to have him on this topic. So, you know, as we get into speaking about substance abuse, we often say that it's a whole of society problem, and that means it touches every single area, no matter what the demographic, no matter what career a person is in, any of those things, socioeconomic, it doesn't matter. It affects everyone, but I think people don't necessarily realize that. And with what you guys are doing there, it's unique because it's centered on first responders, public safety officials, people that are in that world, that I think most people probably think, well, they're not going to deal with that. I mean, these are professionals. They're like often heroes, right? And they don't deal with this kind of stuff. But the reality is actually they do. And looking at some of the stats that you guys put out, I saw that the incident rate in the general public is like 10 to 12%. And then within first responders, it's like 20 to 24%. So it's actually double the amount of incident within first responders. So not only do they not deal with it, but it's actually more common within that environment. And so I'd like to just kind of talk about that and have you share a little bit about yourself, what you do there, and then sure. The unique nature of substance abuse within that first responder world.
Fantastic. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So whatever is happening in the general public, what we know, public safety experiences a lot more. And that comes with post-traumatic stress, with alcohol, with addiction. To back up a little bit, first responder wellness, to give a kind of a high level overview, but it's an inpatient and outpatient treatment center that exclusively works with public safety professionals to treat alcohol, post-traumatic stress, addiction, anxiety and depression. It's a
who would be in that group, just to kind of set the stage. Who we talk about first responders, public safety officials, who's in that group?
Fantastic question. So right now we see about 85% cop and firefighter.
Okay.
And then the other 15% is made up from dispatch, correction. We get a lot of federal agents, wildland firefighters. We've had some deputy district attorneys in the past. Every once in a while, an ER nurse or physician, coroner's office. We've had some records folks. It's really anybody who works in public safety and has trauma from the job. So I would say the overarching issue that people come in with trauma. And then what we know about public safety is many turn to alcohol. It seems to be built into the culture, right, as a coping mechanism. Yeah. And what happens as time goes on is the alcohol use or maybe a substance use increases and it becomes dependence.
Mm-hmm. How would you define trauma? Like you hear this word a lot, and especially in this environment. And just what does that mean, trauma?
Yeah, so I think what we see a lot is, you know, over the course of a responder's career, they're going on pediatric death calls, they're going on shootings, suicides, fatal traffic collisions, you know, and it's not always the bad guy that dies. A lot of times it's, you know, bad things happen to good people. And what we find, a lot of the trauma that is really sticky for the responders that come into our program, it's when they make the right decision and people still lose their life, right? And a couple instances I can cite is we had a firefighter, and I won't mention what agency, but crowded freeway, traffic, 5 o'clock, and there was a family in a car, and the flames had engulfed the car. And by the time the truck got on scene, the captain had to make a decision. Everybody was standing around yelling, right? Help them, help them. But the problem was there was an oil tanker right behind it, and that had started to catch on fire as well. And the captain had to make a decision. The family's pretty much gone. Do I try and save them, right? Or if that tanker blows up, everybody within 50 yards is dead, right? So they had to make the tough decision, put the tanker out, right? And this captain basically worked another, you know, 10, 15 years, retired. And once he retired at night, all he would hear is the people screaming and yelling, save them, save them. Brutal. So he made the right decision, right? He saved hundreds of people. right? But people still died. And that we see that a lot. We also call it moral injury, right? When bad things are happening to good people, and it really kind of breaks your heart. So that's the type of trauma that really becomes sticky for people. And we also notice with a lot of first responders, there's traumatic events that happened earlier in their lives that maybe weren't processed or dealt with correctly. And now they go out onto the job and they see that same thing that happened to them, that happened to a family member of them, and it triggers something.
Like abuse, domestic violence, these types of things.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an interesting survey out there. It's called the ACEs survey. It's the Advanced Childhood Experience Survey. And Kaiser launched the survey in, I think, in the 70s or so. And they put it out to 25,000 people. And they found and asked questions like, I'm not going to mention all 10, but like, hey, did you ever see your parent, you know, sleep with someone that wasn't your mom or dad? Did you ever not have food in the house? Did you ever see a family member, you know, do drugs in front of you? You know, were you ever touched by your family member, and so on, of those things. And when Kaiser put the survey out kind of to the general public, it was about 75% of people responded three or less. Right. What we're finding with a lot of first responders who are suicidal or have completed suicide is they typically have an ACEs score, which is over three. And if you look at the data, if you're four or more, your chance of substance abuse goes up by like 1,000%. Your chance of suicide goes up by like 1,200%. And I could be off on these numbers a little bit, but it just shows how trauma, right, leads us into other things.
Do you think there's a connection between maybe somebody going through something like that and then pursuing a career where the focus is like helping people? It seems like there might be a connection there.
Yeah, I think you're right, right? I think a lot of people rush into the professions thinking, hey, I want to serve. I want to help people. I want to make sure what happened to me or what happened to my friend, right, or my family member doesn't happen to anybody else. So I think there could be a draw a little bit with that. Good question.
Yeah, so I mean, sounds like what you're describing, like, in a, I'll say, normal person's life, not that, you know, first responders aren't normal, but in someone that's not in that field, you may never encounter a situation where you're dealing with death or you're dealing with like extreme violence or something like that. I mean, chances are you might go through your whole life without experiencing that, and then these men and women are experiencing it sometimes on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis. They're having to process this stuff repeatedly.
Yeah, I saw a stat that traumatic events in, you know, in a general public person, right? It's, you know, I don't know, 10 in your life or 7 in your life, something really small. The average first responder is something like 160, I believe, traumatic events in their lives, right? So you can see how you know, they are just affected a lot more by it, you know, and you can say that, hey, I can compartmentalize it, I can ignore it, I can do all those things. And some people do a really good job with it. What we're finding out is that not everybody does. And when we talk about coping mechanisms for public safety, right, alcohol, huge coping mechanism, it's cheap, it's legal, and it works, right? Substance misuse or abuse is another major coping mechanism. Oftentimes, it'll be that injury. You know, I go to the doctor, I get put on a pain medication, and next thing you know, I'm hooked on it. We see sex infidelity and porn as a major coping mechanism. We call these dissociative behaviors, meaning I don't like the way I'm feeling, thinking, and acting. When I engage in this behavior, you know, I get temporary relief. And the problem is it turns into the only coping mechanism. Buying things, right? We see this a lot. You know, how many people do we know that have the new, you know, truck, a new motorcycle, a river house, toys, the gun collection's getting bigger and bigger. I'm one more purchase away from feeling better. And here's the thing that nobody ever thinks about. It's unlimited overtime. If I'm always at work, if I'm always picking up shifts, I'm never at home when it's quiet. And then what happens is you retire and think all I need to do is get across the finish line, right? But all of that trauma that's been compartmentalized and suppressed, you know, now your mind's not occupied. You're retired, right? And a lot of that stuff bubbles up. So we see a lot of retirees end up in our program. We typically get a call from the retiree themselves or a family member 2 or 3 years after retirement, and they'll say, God, they never really had a problem with alcohol. You know, now they're drinking every day. You know, what is it? And it's really a coping mechanism to deal with a lot of those traumas. So not everybody that comes to our program that has an alcohol or substance misuse diagnosis mm-hmm. is really an alcoholic, mm-hmm. right? A lot of them are using it to cope with the trauma. Mm-hmm. But we find that a lot of them, really, enjoy going to AA meetings, and they feel like, hey, they do have an inappropriate relationship mm-hmm. with alcohol. So what we try and do is we try to present all the information, but not lead them down a path either way and let them make their own decision. Mm-hmm. And we find that some of them, do cops and firefighter AA meetings okay. after they leave our program.
Yeah, it's good. Community is so important, community, relationships, healthy relationships, a supportive community, having purpose right. is also huge. Right. I mean, I would imagine for retirees, yeah. they go from having this, amazing mission and purpose every day. And now, yeah. like, what am I doing now?
Yeah.
Right. It's probably very important to get involved and engaged in something yeah. else that's productive.
Yeah. Oftentimes, especially as men, right, we're mm-hmm. so, we identify so much with what we do for a mm-hmm. living, our career.
Oh, yeah. What's the first thing you ask somebody when you meet them?
Yeah.
Hey, what do you do?
What do you do? Yeah. and to have yeah. that, like, hey, you're so, especially as a first responder, you're so important. Mm-hmm. You're always on the inside. You always have that information, right? Mm-hmm. And you cross the finish line very young. You're about 50, right? When you can retire. And then, where does your purpose come from? We actually created a workshop called Retire Well, because we mm-hmm. saw a lot of retirees coming into our program. We thought, how can we reverse engineer what these retirees are experiencing to deploy training earlier in their career so that mm-hmm. way they're more prepared? And what it looks at identity, purpose. Mm-hmm. What happens when I take off the super suit? Where does my value come from? Mm. Unresolved trauma or grief or compartmentalized. And then something really important, especially for firefighters, is what does reintegration to the home look like? Because your spouse has potentially been at home running the household for 25 years, and now you're home and you're retired every day, and you see a lot of inefficiencies. And should you bring those up? Right? Like, what does that look like at home? So I think it's really important more preparation needs to be done.
Yeah. So I was watching one of the videos by your chief clinical officer,
yes.
and he was talking about hypervigilance, mm-hmm. right? Like within first responders, and this like actually makes physiological changes within the body that can often lead to substance abuse and trying to deal with this. Can you like explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so you did your homework.
Yeah,
you watched some of the videos.
Trying to, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, so, oftentimes, when the calls happen, there are mm-hmm. stress chemicals that get released for the public safety professionals that are going out on these calls. Mm-hmm. And what happens is they get so used to it that they don't feel it anymore. But oftentimes people remember the radio call, remember the tones their first year, mm-hmm. And then they remember how it affected them at 5 years. And then by that time, it's kind of like it's no big deal. But what happens is there are stress chemicals that are released in your body and your brain, and they typically mm-hmm. will, you don't process them very quickly. So they could be in your system for 8 hours, for 12 hours, for 16 mm-hmm. hours or more. Mm-hmm. So there's a chance if something happened at the end of your shift, by the time you go back on, right, those stress chemicals are still in your body. Mm. Oftentimes what they do is our brains are neuroplastic. And then we have these two little things called amygdalas. And amygdalas are responsible for fight or flight. Mm-hmm. The problem with those stress chemicals is they can grow our amygdalas, which usually start out as the size of an almond. Mm-hmm. They can grow it to the size of a walnut. Right. And that essentially
just from repeated stress
chemicals. Yeah. We'll grow mm-hmm. that. Right. So now you're always in fight or flight. It's what we call the reptilian part of the brain. Mm-hmm. Right. And what that does is it creates that hypervigilance. Mm-hmm. Right. And maybe the only way you get relief, right, is with a whiskey, is with mm-hmm. a beer, is with a cocktail. Right. So we see a lot of people just, they're not necessarily drinking all the time. Right. It's not that. Mm-hmm. Dependence. And we see this a lot with firefighters. It's mm-hmm. funny when firefighters come into treatment, and we had to figure this out way back when, it's their detox doesn't start for at least 24, 48 hours in, because they're used to drinking when they're off, mm-hmm. going into the firehouse, staying for a 24, 48 hour shift, and then drinking when they get back. So their body's used to it. It's been trained for that. Mm. So, when someone like a law enforcement officer is coming in, they usually will go into withdrawal much sooner. So we had the kind of...
Because it was more regular.
Because they're going working 12, 14-hour shifts, and they're drinking, mm-hmm. right? So they could go 12, 14 hours without going into withdrawal. Mm. With the firefighters, their bodies have been conditioned to maybe be a couple days. So it's something we had to very closely monitor. But yeah, so alcohol is just one of those things that, you know how it is, right? Most mm-hmm. of us took our first drink well before we were 21 years old. I know I did.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, when I had that first drink, it affected me, and it affected me in a way where I knew it affected me differently than my friends. Mm-hmm. Right. And it, you know, I just felt like, ooh, this feels good. Right. This is giving me relief for all my problems. Right. Maybe I'm not as up here. Maybe I'm not as angry as I was, you know, prior to having that drink. So I think a lot, the same thing happens with the public safety. It's like, how can I take the edge off? Mm-hmm. And it's built into the culture.
Yeah. And how about that? Just, I'd love to hear your perspective on that with the culture, because I'm sure that culture within the precinct or within the firehouse or, you know, whatever their area is different than normal, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of machismo, a lot of, you know, I don't need help, I got this, almost seen as a weakness to admit that you have a problem.
Right.
I would imagine that that's a big challenge in this field.
Yeah, I remember early on, like back in 2019, when we were going to meet with an association, and we went to their, you know, Union Hall, Association Hall, and the woman was taking us back to find an office, and every office she kept going to wasn't available. And she looked over, and someone said, "Why not the conference room?" And she looked over and said, "They're doing choir practice in the conference room." And choir practice is when everybody got off shift in the morning, they grab beer and they go over there and they drink. Okay. Right. So, and I've heard this a lot with a lot of, you know, choir practice, what they call it. Right.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so it's just normal, right? Mm-hmm. It's normal. So it's not normal to, you know, especially when you're coming onto a culture, it's kind of like, it's, that's the way it's always been done. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, we have people that show up in our program and maybe they weren't drinking. Maybe alcohol was never an issue, right? Mm-hmm. But they started, you know, hanging out with everybody and alcohol was always there. And then it just turned into more of a coping mechanism as time went on. And then the dependence came, right? And
there's a progression, maybe a social thing. Then it's like, wow, this actually helps with the stuff that I'm dealing with on the job. And any of these substances, you use them long enough, you're going to become dependent on them.
Yeah, we see a lot of people that, hey, I can't go to sleep without, you know, having a couple of shots. We see that a lot too. Right. And then it starts into, hey, my anxiety is so bad before, you know, I go to the ball game or before I do something on the weekend, I'm also drinking as well. Yeah.
What do you see a high incidence of suicide within first responders, you know, maybe whether successful or not?
Yeah.
Is there that component?
Yeah, well, I think the statistics are out that basically say us that more public safety professionals, more first responders die by suicide than in the line of duty.
Wow.
You know, so I can tell you that every time I see a suicide or I hear about a suicide, I think to myself, you know, that person didn't know there's programs like ours out there.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is, you know, we've worked really hard to create a program that's very successful. We have a 90% reduction, excuse me, a 70% reduction in PTSD scores from on average from admission to discharge, and a 94% return to work rate.
Wow.
Right. So, you know, yeah, suicide is, it's real. It's happening a lot, you know, but every time I hear about that, I think like, oh, I wish we had reached out to that department. I wish we knew somebody over there that really get the message out. You know, we've had people that have come into our program that haven't taken it serious, that never got vulnerable, that never let down their walls. And then years later, I've heard that they've committed suicide. So I think it's something that really affects public safety. And I think probably the reason for that is culture and stigma, right? I don't want to ask for help. That's not what we do, right? We're the heroes. We help people, right? And my thought is it takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of strength to ask for help. You know, that first year I talked to everybody, I talked to everybody that came through our program and I can't tell you when someone calls the tremendous amount of pain they're in and they feel like they're not fixable. And what I would always do, and I would always listen to what they had to say and I would let them know, hey, listen, I want to be straight with you. I know you think like this is only happening to you, but I talk to people in your profession every single day that are going through the same thing. Right. And the good news is, you know, at the time we've had 400 people through our program, we've had 600 people, 800 people, whatever it was. I would just say, hey, we've had this many people through our program. They're back at work and they're not divorced and they're with their families and they're connected to their kids. Right. And so, you know, it's not a death sentence, right? You can survive this. You can overcome this. And, you know, the neat thing about our program is, I'll tell you this, everybody thinks it's only happening to them. And right. far before they get to our program, they've known something's wrong. They know something's really wrong. They don't know what it is. They're afraid if they tell anybody, they'll lose their job. So they've been walking around yeah. with the secret for many, many years. They often turn the alcohol. They often turn the substances as a coping mechanism or some of those other ones I've talked about. But the neat thing is when they walk into our program, not everybody gets there on the same day. What I mean by that is we're a long-term program, 30-day minimum. A lot of our average length of stay is right around 70 days. Some people stay a lot longer than that. Mm-hmm. So when I walk in and I'm the new guy, right, with that secret that I haven't shared with anybody, and I sit in a group, and you've been here for 2 months, somebody else has been here for 3 or 4 months, and they're talking out loud about that secret, and I'm the new guy, and I go, holy smokes, right? It's not just me. Mm-hmm. And if they're being honest around it, this must be a place I can trust. Mm-hmm. What we notice is the walls come down very quickly, mm-hmm. and they start to trust and start to open up. And what we know about trauma, right, is if we talk about it and we process it, we can move on.
Yeah. Bring it out into the light.
Correct.
In the dark, it's going to fester.
Yeah.
And I think, what you just kind of described is also not just exclusive to first responders. Right. That's one of the big reasons why we are doing this podcast is just to let people know you're not alone. Right. You're not the only one dealing with it, right? There's just this mentality where it's just this specific segment of society. These are the people and it's nobody else. And so when someone outside of that is dealing with it, I feel like they're the only one. And it's just not the case. So having these conversations is really important. Yeah. So you mentioned like the group stuff. So that seems to be a big component, certainly, of your program, the peer support side of it, just coming alongside and letting people, operate in that environment. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So our program, traditionally, we get referrals to the program from peer support, from clinicians. Mm-hmm. We have a sister organization called the Counseling Team International, which we merged with 3 years ago. And they contract with hundreds of agencies to provide short-term counseling, crisis response, training and education, and then they do pre-employment psych testing. So when we talk to an agency, we always ask, hey, how's peer support? Do you have peer support team, right? Because that foundational element that your wellness program will be built on, it has to have two components. It has to have a strong peer support and good culturally competent clinicians, right? Mm-hmm. And they work hand in hand. Because peer supporters, they're making the referrals to the clinicians 9 out of 10 times. It's very rarely that they come to the treatment center that it's that, elevated. But when they do, they have to know what the resource is. So we do peer support training all over the country. Mm-hmm. Especially in this region, we have, quite a few departments that we work with. But I think peer support is fundamental for employee wellness.
Okay. Could you define wellness? Because I see that term comes up a lot. And what would that be?
Yeah, so there's 8 dimensions of wellness. Mm-hmm. It's not all, let's see if I can name them all right.
All right, this is like a quiz.
emotional, physical, psychological, spiritual, financial, physical. There's 2 others.
So we're talking about holistic, the whole of the person. And we're totally on board. I mean, we believe that addiction, maybe it's simplified, but it's spirit, soul, and body, right? It's like, it's all 3 of those components. Right. And any, initial causes, continuing causes, and solutions have to address these things, or you're only getting one little piece of it.
Yeah, mind, body, and spirit.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so when we look at a holistic approach, you look at the 8 dimensions of it, we call it a wellness wheel, right? Mm-hmm. The 8 dimensions of the wellness wheel, and we need to be having progress in all of those. Mm-hmm. So part of what we do at our program is we work on a discharge plan, and that really starts on day one. We start to look at, hey, what comes next? Because you may be with us 60 days, you may be with us 45 days, you may be with us 120 days, but that's just a sliver of your life, right? And what's really important is what happens when you leave. So we look at the 8 dimensions of wellness, and we start to focus on, hey, what are you willing to do? And then the discharge plan is not what we're dictating to you. It's like, hey, let's work together because we can come up with a plan. If you're not willing to do it, then
you got to have buy-in from the person.
Yeah. Who cares? Right. Yeah. So before someone leaves, they work with their case manager to put together a discharge plan that looks at all those areas, because when people get to the treatment center, we have to decide, what are we treating while you're here? What are we referring maybe to an outside while you're with us? Or then what are we deferring to what comes after treatment? Because we have to really triage and work at the crisis point. And oftentimes it is about 65% of our clients that come in with alcohol or substance use, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to stabilize that and treat that. And then the big thing is trauma. You know, we see anxiety and depression as well, but the overarching thing is trauma. And if we don't treat the underlying issues, it's real easy to go back to those coping mechanisms, which are alcohol or substances. But I think you're right. I think it does affect everybody, right? It doesn't make a difference if you're a judge, you're a politician, you have a lot of money, you have a little bit of money. I've been sober 15 years and been...
So it's your background too, huh?
Yeah, I've been...
I think I missed that okay. My research.
Yeah. Okay. So I've been sober 15 years and, you know, literally, in my opinion, I crawled out of the gutter, right? And because I was willing to go to a 12-step program, because I was willing to get a sponsor, do the steps, because I was willing to follow direction, because I was willing to sponsor other people, go on retreats, to do all those things, right? I have a really good life. But I'll tell you, I've lost a lot of people. A lot of non-first responders, a lot of people, because my whole community is sober. So my wife's sober, our friends are sober. And about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, we had a three-week span where we lost four people that were really close to us. Two suicides and two overdoses.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and it's you know, and it's, they weren't bad people. They weren't criminals, right? They just struggled with depression and addiction, and sometimes the shame of relapse can be overwhelming. And that's something we found with public safety is, you know, anger and shame are not two things that public safety does well. And you add alcohol and sometimes bad things happen like suicide when that's happening. So for us at our program, we feel it's real important to be honest about what it takes to never have to go back to a program or struggle again. And it's a lot, right? We say, come in, give us 60 to 90 days. You know, let the walls down, do all the work, get vulnerable, follow your aftercare plan. It's still going to be really hard. But if you do all those things, the likelihood of coming back to our program or a program like ours is very, very low.
So I wanted to go back to something you had said a little bit earlier and just kind of zero in on, you know, for those people that might be dealing with something, what are some of the signs? What would be the things, like you're living in this culture where you got to put on this, you know, super suit and act like everything's great, and maybe you've never had a problem with substance abuse, but now you're thinking maybe there might be a problem. I'm not sure. There might be a problem. What would be some things that a person would look for?
Well, I think, you know, you don't want to get relief from any one thing. Like we talked about the eight dimensions of wellness. You want to have a robust life. And, you know, are you drinking by yourself? Are you drinking every day? Are you isolating, right? One of the kind of the hallmark trademarks is, am I staying at home drinking, right? And it doesn't mean...
It's not like a social thing anymore.
Correct. And it doesn't mean going and drinking out with friends every day is the answer either. Sure. But you look at those things. Do you have hobbies still? Does your whole life revolve around your job, right? Is that, you know, where we see people, and this is the unfortunate thing, right? Because the profession, you know, people get hurt. They get medically retired. And when we see the people that do well in retirement and they do well when they're medically retired, had an identity outside, you know? So you hear a lot at the academy, you know, keep your social circle, keep your friends. It's good to have, you know, your work friends, but it's also good to have other friends. Don't have it all be this, because if something goes wrong, right? So coming back to your question, what are some of the things to look for? You know, I think if you're not sleeping at night, right, which is a funny thing to say to a firefighter, because of course, you know, they're not sleeping well at night, but those are some of the things to look at, right? Not sleeping at night, agitation, you know, getting mad at things that you normally wouldn't be getting mad, like that's your go-to.
Irritability,
yeah, that's your go-to. And then having alcohol be your coping mechanism, even if you have a couple drinks every night, hey, you just go to, you sleep better because of that, you know? So
what would be a better coping mechanism? Like if somebody's listening to this, right? Yeah. And they're like, wow, that is me.
Yeah.
Well, they still got to cope with it, right?
100%.
The trauma's there. They're dealing with the stuff. Yeah. You got to deal with it in some kind of a healthy way.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it hasn't got to the point that they need to go into a program or something, but what would be a healthy way to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. Great. So, you know, going to the gym, going for a jog, you know, going out to lunch and hanging out with your friends socially, you know, going for a hike, you know.
So physical activity.
Yeah, physical activity is great, right? But maintaining relationships is another good one.
You just mentioned hobbies.
My mind went blank for a second. But yeah, having hobbies, right? So it's when people stop, you know, whether you used to, you know, go fishing, whether you used to go hunting, right? Whether you used to tinker on the car, like what are your hobbies, you know? Are you calling your friends, right? You know, what are those things? I think also too, you know, go see a clinician. You know, 6 states in the country have mandated wellness visits for law enforcement, and what a annual wellness visit is, it's not a fitness for duty. It's not an evaluation. There's no notes taken. There's no diagnosing. It's basically a one-on-one with a clinician, and it's more education than therapy, but you're by yourself with a clinician, because some people have never seen a clinician their whole career. Right? So it gives
kind of like a little checkup, a mental health checkup.
Yeah. Kinda. Well, we try to call it a wellness visit because checkup sounds like, what are they checking up on me?
Okay. Has negative connotations.
Yeah. So wellness visit. So we're doing this with a lot of the agencies we work with at the counseling team, but I think that's another great, take advantage of the resources that are there.
What are those 6 states?
I know Nevada's one of them. I don't know the others.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's 6 of them.
But even if your state doesn't mandate it, it's probably available.
Yeah, a lot of departments are doing it. Yeah, so more and more agencies are reaching out to us. We actually just wrote up some policy around it for a couple agencies. One of the local agencies, the Corona Police Department, has been doing it for 14, 15 years. Oh, not everybody necessarily goes every year. It's every couple, it's every 2 or 3. But I would highly, you know, suggest that most of these issues where people end up in the treatment center, if they sought a clinician, if they changed their behavior earlier, if they processed that trauma, if they didn't go down that road of the negative coping mechanisms, they would never end up in a treatment center. That's why we say going to
preventable.
It's preventable. Going to a debrief, right? When the clinician comes out, right? We don't want to force anybody that's talking to debrief, but going to a debrief, right? Processing that trauma. If you don't feel comfortable with talking in front of everybody, talking to peer support, finding a clinician to process that. I can't tell you how often we have a clinician go out to do a debrief, and he or she's working with peer support, and they'll talk, they'll do the debrief, and there's somebody that never says a word. And then when the clinician's walking to their car, they come up and say, stop hey, them. Can I get your card? As a matter of fact, I got a message this morning, hey, we have a first responder in distress, you know, who can see him in the next 2 hours.
Right? And that, what is that? It sounds like that's a key word, distress. Is that like signify the level of, you know, urgency?
Yeah. So at the counseling team, we have 2 clinicians on standby every day to respond to crises. And then we also keep a couple hours open for crisis during the day. So if a first responder calls, right, we can get them in to see a clinician right away. Because what we know about public safety is, you know, because of culture and stigma, they've probably waited about 5 years past when a member of the general public would have raised their hand and asked for help. So a lot of times, you know, in behavioral health, especially in chemical dependency, we say there's no such thing as a chemical dependency emergency. That's not the case with public safety because of the suicide rate and the epidemic. And we know that these men and women have held on to the bitter end.
So it seems like a big part of the challenge is that culture and the stigma, like trying to change people's mindsets to where they don't feel like I can't do this, or I have to hide trying to get help, or they feel comfortable being able to do it. And their peers aren't going to be like, you know, you sissy,
right?
You know, what are you doing?
Right.
So it seems like that's probably one of the big challenges.
I would say the one silver lining of the pandemic is it raised everybody's resting anxiety up 3 or 4 notches. So I think just about anybody understands when someone else is going through something, right? Because theirs, but not everybody is ready to make that commitment or ask for help for themselves. But when they hear about somebody else, they're like, hey, I'm glad he asked for help. But I want to talk about too, you know, how we're affecting change and changing culture and really normalizing this. So we do a lot of training and education at departments to really, you know, let people know far before they're in a crisis situation. And it's neat when we do training for not just the peer support team, but really every employee, because you often see people in the crowd have this aha moment. It's well before, right? It's well before they're in crisis. And I'll look out and see people often hit their buddy and be like, hey, I think this is what's going on with me. And it's great to see them realize ahead of time and think, oh, I can go see a therapist. I can go see a counselor and solve a lot of their issues. And then what we've also started to do, because it seems like once you get promoted into leadership, you're out of peer support, but who's providing wellness for the leadership? You know, you still have those same traumas. So we created a resilience retreat, and actually it's now called a workshop because the chiefs have told us workshop sounds better, but we've created a workshop. It's a multi-day workshop, and we do it up in Idlewild, and we take police chiefs and sheriffs together, just them, and we do a 2-night, 3-day resilience workshop. Mm. And it's almost like, hey, how can we keep you healthy rather than have to wait till the wheels fall off or gets bad and be proactive? And it's neat to see the chiefs actually want to go on this, go through it, and then come back and realize that there's more they could be doing for their agency in regards to wellness.
That's what I was just thinking. I mean, not only is it beneficial for them personally, but then it kind of exposes them to the dangers of the people that, you know, they're overseeing and being more open and willing, you know, to get them help.
It's neat. So police chiefs, we have a separate one for fire chiefs, and then we have a command staff retreat as well, because we don't want anybody to be isolated, right? And we know that if leadership is bought in the wellness, if leadership is doing their own work, then the likelihood that they're going to have a strong program in their department is going to be high.
Yeah, it's so good. How long has your guys' center been up and running?
Yeah. So it was founded by Dr. Stephen Odom in 2018. He had had a general population program. This is about 2011. Mm-hmm. And he basically wanted to start a public safety program. That pretty much that whole time, but knew public safety really wasn't ready. You know, it takes a lot to break in to public safety, have them trust us. Mm-hmm. And so in 2017, he started going out and meeting with agencies, with associations, with clinicians, and started asking questions about like, hey, if I created a public safety program, what would you want to see? And the feedback was pretty much unanimous. Hey, we want a program that's only public safety. We want a program that treats more than just alcohol. And we want a program that takes our insurance. So First Responder Wellness was born in 2018. And, you know, that first year or so, we never had any more than, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people max. And then it's crazy to see what it's grown into over the years. You know, last year, I want to say we averaged about 65 people in the program. And a little earlier this year, we had as many as about 80 in the program, really from all over the country. So 65% come from California.
Not just Southern
California. Yeah, I mean, really, there's 5 programs in the United States that have been vetted and approved by the Fraternal Order of Police. Mm-hmm. We're one of 5. And then we just got an endorsement from PORAC just literally last week.
What is that?
PORAC is Peace Officers Research Association, and it's one of the largest law enforcement associations in California. So I think they have about 60,000 members.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So were there many programs before 2018, or is this like one of the pilot programs?
Yeah. So over the years, I've heard there's lots of treatment centers that have tried to do this and have opened up and then gone out of business. Since we've been open, there's been a bunch that have opened up and then gone out of business as well. It's starting to be more popular. So we see more and more programs pop up, which ultimately is a good thing. I think some people don't understand public safety, and that's not always good. And what I mean by that is, you know, when we have a copper firefighter come in that's in a crisis, this is really like, it's serious, right? And if you're not really set up to help these men and women, but you just, you know, you want to do well, it could be more dangerous. And I'll give you an example. When I first started, I started calling agencies in the Las Vegas area, and nobody wanted to talk to me. And years later, when we finally built relationship with like Las Vegas Metro and Henderson and all the agencies out there, they told us after the Route 91 shooting, you know, they had to literally put up the walls and say no more clinicians, and they kicked a lot of people out. The problem was is every clinician wanted the help and drove in, but they weren't culturally competent. They didn't understand the culture, right? And in some ways, they were doing more harm than good, right? So I want to encourage anybody who's thinking about opening up a public safety program to really do their research, to really find culturally competent clinicians, to understand the culture, because it's really important. And we like to say that, you know, we have one chance a lot of times, right? And it could be life or death.
That's a good point. I also noticed on one of the documents, it was talking about you guys changed PTSD to PTSI. So what is the thought behind that?
You know, so the clinical diagnosis is still PTSD. There's been a big movement in public safety to, you know, disorder sounds serious, which, you know, post-traumatic stress is, but disorder almost sounds like something you don't recover from. Well, everybody's had an injury. So post-traumatic stress injury, when we talk about it as an injury, mentally we know, okay, so what do I need to do to rehab my injury? What are those steps, right? And it almost makes it more conquerable. right? So there's been a big movement in public
safety. It's also
safety.
A term that I would imagine first responders are very familiar with, injury.
Yeah.
Right, dealing with injury.
I think it's, I like to say that everything an agency does either increases stigma or decreases stigma, right? And by saying, hey, post-traumatic stress injuries happen, here's our process when you have a post-traumatic stress injury, and here's how we're going to support you, getting healed and back to work.
Okay.
I think public safety has this weird thing with psychology. Everybody takes a pre-employment psychological test, right? And if they had any type of disorder, right, they maybe not be fit for duty. So it's like, how do I stay away from something like that? So I think it's just like you said earlier, how do we take post-traumatic stress out of the darkness and push it into the light and make it something that everybody can talk about and make it something that's normal? Because if it's normal to develop post-traumatic stress, but it's also normal to admit, right, that maybe I'm not operating at 100%, and here's some steps I can follow to get back to that point, then I think we'd have a lot less people entering our long-term program.
Good. Well, what would you, good chance there'll be people listening into this that are first responders and maybe dealing with some of these things. What would be your advice to them?
Yeah. I think that, whatever you're struggling with, no matter what it is, right, there's probably a solution, right? And the sooner you ask for help, the better. What we see at the treatment center is funny. The first year or two we opened, there was a lot of older responders coming in, and now we're seeing a lot more younger responders. And I think it's just Generation Z. They're open to talking about their feelings a lot more. But I would just encourage people that, it's hard. Right? It's hard to deal with stress, and it's, sometimes you don't know what's happening, but when you make your coping mechanism something that's negative, right? And you start down that path, I don't think anybody sets out to say, I'm going to be an alcoholic, I'm going to use alcohol every day to go to sleep, or I'm going to have to drink to go to be in a social situation. But when you start using it as in a situation like that, right? Dependence happens. So I would say just take advantage of the clinicians, culturally competent clinicians. Call us if you need us to help you find one, right? Go on a retreat, right? There's public safety retreats. The West Coast post-trauma retreat's a great retreat. We have a trauma and resilience retreat as well, right? But reach out. Like a retreat's great.
Like within their department, or like within that, or even outside of that, or like online?
Great question. So more and more agencies are contracting with culturally competent clinicians. So they may have like the Magellan or the big box EAP that aren't culturally competent, and they get the 3 sessions and they're not finding a lot of use for that, right? And word travels very fast with public safety. Like and somebody gets a new truck, everybody's getting a new truck. When someone finds a new tile guy, everybody's using the tile guy. Same thing. When someone knows that when you call EAP, it's a waste of time, no one's going to call EAP. So a lot of agencies are starting to reach out to organizations like ours and contract for culturally competent clinicians. So at the counseling team, we provide 10 sessions per employee per year. So that's enough to handle your short-term issues. So reach out, find out what your resources are. Find out if there's a culturally competent clinician that takes your insurance. And then retreats. So what's nice about retreats, and here's what we're really encouraging more agencies to look and be proactive. It's very disruptive for the agency. It's very disruptive for the employee to come to our program for 45 days, for 90 days. It costs a lot of money to backfill those positions. If more agencies would send people proactively on retreats, so the Riverside County Sheriff's Department has an officer involved shooting retreat. The counseling team, our clinicians worked that retreat, right? So if more departments were sending there as a matter of policy, not to say, hey, we know you're good, but within 6 to 12 months, you're going to go up to the OIS retreat, right? You're going to go to the trauma and resilience retreat we offer, right? It could be a firefighter. Hey, you were on a really gruesome call. We know you're okay, but let's not wait for 18 months or 24 months till you're not sleeping, right? We're going to send you proactively on a retreat like this.
And are those voluntary?
Yeah.
So they need to, so it might be available in somebody's department. Doesn't mean they're going to take advantage of it.
Right. It doesn't, but we're trying to educate more about being proactive. And I think we get a lot of calls at the treatment center that also say, hey, we have somebody, they're not really that bad to go away for that long. What are some of the other things we can send people to proactively? So it's nice about the retreat. Well, it's nice about a retreat, right? It's 2 or 3 nights, 3 or 4 nights, right? So it's like you can get your shifts covered. It's not like it's super disruptive for your family. You can tell your kids if you don't want to be honest with them about what you're doing, you know, and tell them you're going to Aunt Susie's house or whatever it's going to be, right? But take care of yourself. I would say take care of yourself, because what happens is you get to retire fairly young, right? And if you don't take care of yourself, and it's not just psychologically, but physically, emotionally, if you don't take care of yourself, right, you're going to have to deal with it later.
Would you encourage people, even if they... even if they don't identify with any of these things, would you still encourage them, go to the retreat? You know, you never know what's underneath, right?
So I'll tell you a quick story. So we had a peer support team. So we offer a peer support team retreat. And we had a peer support team go to the retreat. Well, the lieutenant was on the peer support team. She went back to the chief and said, "Chief, we need to send every officer through this retreat." And, you know, the chief said, "Hey, we're a police department. You know, what do you mean?" Right. And she explained what they did on the retreat. And we're in year three of a 3-year commitment by that chief to get every single employee through a wellness retreat. In year two, they started sending professional staff as well. So I can tell you, right, that from what we saw, there wasn't a ton of pushback. And it looks like just regular cops were looking for a way to come up, to dump, to not make a big deal. Right. And never talk about again, a bunch of stuff, and go back to work.
Yeah.
Right. So I think it's incredible what that department, what that chief, it does sound very healthy.
Yeah.
Right. Was able to do over a 3-year
period. Got to have buy-in though. You got to have buy-in from the leadership that you did there. So that seems like that's a big thing, is really getting buy-in from the top.
Right. Yeah.
So what would you, just kind of to wrap it up, if you, you know, your program there is there in Newport Beach, you said you, you know, are available to people all across the country.
Absolutely.
What would be, you know, some resources, some other resources that somebody might reach out if they're not available to come to yours, or you guys don't have space? Is there like hotline number? What would somebody Google?
Yeah. So I would encourage you to call us. So it's First Responder Wellness. Okay. So the website is firstresponder-wellness.com. There's a number to call our admissions team to talk about them. If you're not appropriate for our program, we could help you find resources. If our program isn't the right program for you, we can help you get to the right program. We just worked with a first responder recently, and you know, we weren't the best fit for them, so we were able to get them to another program to handle their primary issue. So they went there for the first 30-40 days, and then they came to our program to work on their trauma afterwards. We also have a resource tab on our website, and there are about 6 or 7 first responder, we call it first responder fellowship, but they're post-traumatic stress
I saw those. There were some Zoom meetings.
Yeah, there's 4 or 5 Zoom meetings that anybody can log in from anywhere. So I want to be clear, those are not our groups. We have helped all of the first responders start their own groups, and we gave them a meeting format. So
it's obvious
consistent.
You guys want to help, right? It's
absolutely.
Not, it's not just, we want everybody to come to our program.
Correct.
It's like, you just want to help. I mean, if it's a good fit at your program, awesome.
Correct.
If it's not, you want to direct them to something that is a good fit for them.
Correct. Yep. Yeah. So I would encourage people to reach out for help. Start with a clinician, start with your local clinician, you know, and just remember that clinicians are people. And you may not like your first clinician, but they're not all the same. And to never give up and keep on trying, right?
So you find one that works, huh?
100%.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're grateful. Thank you, Devin, for coming and sharing. I mean, this sounds like it is offering a lot of hope to people if they'll accept it, if they'll reach out and participate and take advantage of that. And we're, you know, hoping and praying for success for you guys there. And again, thank you for coming out.
Great. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. Right. Thank you.
Thank you for being a part of this much needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.